It's 7 a.m. in Tokyo, 11 p.m. in London, and 6 p.m. here in New York. I'm Julia Chatterley, and wherever you are in the world, this is your First Move. Welcome to First Move once again, and here's today's Need to Know. From coast to coast, pro-Palestinian protests erupt across U.S. college campuses. U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson shouted down in New York as he condemned extremism. Arizona taking steps to repeal an abortion ban dating back to 1864 as the Supreme Court debates access to emergency abortions. Burrito Bonanza, U.S. restaurant chain Chipotle, serving up some tasty earnings thanks in part to higher prices. We'll make a meal of it with their CFO shortly. Plus,
I hope that Japan will soon become a place where people are not surprised when a woman becomes a president.
And from flight attendant to the top flight, the CEO of Japan Airlines urging others to fly high. That conversation and much more coming up. But first, to escalating tensions across U.S. college campuses, pro-Palestinian demonstrations continue at schools across the United States criticizing Israel's war in Gaza. This is the scene from University of Texas at Austin Weston Wednesday, where several arrests were made. You can see state troopers there dressed in riot gear. Meanwhile, over on the West Coast at the University of Southern California, protesters there also clashing with police. The college now requiring students to show ID in order to get on campus. And here in New York, as I mentioned, House Speaker Mike Johnson visited Columbia University and called on President Mnuchin to resign. He also had this to say.
The cherished traditions of this university are being overtaken right now by radical and extreme ideologies. They place a target on the backs of Jewish students in the United States and here on this campus. A growing number of students have chanted in support of terrorists. They have chased down Jewish students. They have mocked them and reviled them. They have shouted racial epithets. They have screamed at those who bear the Star of David. Enjoy your free speech.
And Columbia University officials just in the last 30 minutes to an hour denying rumors that the school threatened to call in the National Guard to help address the crisis. Isabel Rosales is at Brown University in Rhode Island, where an encampment has been set up. And Isabel, regular viewers will remember that we spoke to you yesterday as well. What have you seen today and what have you been saying to some of the students there that have spoken to you?
Hey, Julia, let me actually give you a new development. We just got a hold of an email sent to the student body from the president of Brown, who states that unlike what we've seen at other campuses, there have been no altercations here. There have been no reports of intimidation, of harassment, of violence, untoward behavior here on Brown's campus. And in this lengthy email that we just got a hold of, she also spoke about censorship. And she said this, I am writing to assure you all that this will not happen at Brown. Freedom of expression is a right that guarantees the ability of individual members of the community to express their views, period. So she's saying they will not be expelling students, firing faculty based on them expressing their views here on campus. And as far as what we've seen, this encampment of just over 20 tents here, this all came about since this morning. All of these tents, 100 plus protesters coming in and out of this green area throughout the day, chanting, singing, saying from Columbia to Brown, we will not let Gaza down. And Julia, let me have you look that way. To the left, right over here, that brick building right there, that is the administrative building. So you have school officials being able to hear these chants, being able to see this growing encampment from these windows. We also know, and we witnessed in the past couple of hours, in a circle of these demonstrators right over here, we saw university police escorting school officials as they had this machine and started scanning school IDs one by one by one. We know that these students nonetheless face disciplinary action because it is against school policy to have an encampment here on these grounds. But I spoke to several of them, including an organizer who is Jewish, and he said time will show that we are on the right side of history here. I don't care that I'm facing potentially an arrest or disciplinary action. We will stay out here. We will not leave until our demands are met. What are their demands, Julia? They are to divest in any companies here, for Brown to divest of any companies that have ties to the Israeli government. And also, they are asking for protection of free speech on campus, specifically for charges to be dropped against 41 students who back in December in a pro-Palestinian protest, a sit-in inside of that building, they faced charges because of that incident back in December. So a lot of passion here from these students saying they will not leave. They have a message that needs to be heard. Of course, we've heard around campuses around the nation, other Jewish students on campus that have certainly felt uncomfortable by what they're witnessing. But this is a very nuanced conversation that's happening from all sides, the student movement, the youth leading this moment, and these protests spreading across different campuses across the United States. Julia.
Certainly. And it's interesting to your point that they're now swiping to make sure that it is students that are there and perhaps not outsiders that are also looking to influence some of these debates. As you said, the administration there is saying, look, it's OK. And we're seemingly seeing peaceful protests and that's OK. How long do those that you've spoken to in the encampment expect to stay then if they're waiting for their demands to be met? And have we heard anything from officials there about those negotiations?
They said that they will stay here until those demands are met. So they don't look to be budging at all. I will also say that commencement, graduation is May 24th, I believe, toward the end of May. And these are the grounds where that graduation ceremony takes place. So something you would imagine has to give. Either they move that commencement or they take these tents away. We were told by the school that if laws are broken or if things escalate, that's when they would bring some police officers on site here. That may involve arrest. But so far, again, the school saying, listen, this is them expressing, you know, their views. There's been no instances of violence, of intimidation, of harassment, none of that. So this is their First Amendment right.
Yeah, Isabel Rosales there. Thank you so much for that report. And we'll leave you there in Rhode Island. Bringing it back to New York now, Joseph Stiglitz is a Nobel Prize winning economist and a professor at Columbia University. My colleague Paula Newton asked him what he thought of the House Speaker, Mike Johnson, calling for the school president to resign. Just take a listen.
I disagree with him strongly. What I think is that he should resign. That he is interfering in a fundamental way with a basic way in which our society works. Academic freedom. Academic freedom is really important to the running not only of our universities, but of our society. Universities are an important critic of what government does, and if we lose that academic freedom, our country, I think, is in a very bad shape.
Okay, let's get more on the wider significance of these protests. National security analyst Juliet KM joins us now. Juliet, great to have you with us. I think first and foremost, and we were just hearing from Isabel there where they were scanning IDs and everything seemed very calm. That's very different from perhaps what we saw at the University of Texas in Austin earlier today. How do you maintain safety? How do you make sure that every student on campus is safe in this environment first and foremost?
Yeah, so first of all, you have to define safe. And so there's a difference between opinions you don't like or opinions that make you feel uncomfortable and then physically being threatened or feel that you're physically being threatened. And I think we have to, universities and colleges have to be in particular very sensitive to this because they have a diversity of viewpoints. They embrace those diversity of viewpoints. And so the way, you know, I sort of feel like, and I'm sure viewers are experiencing it, like everything was fine 2 days ago. And now it seems like every college and university is having some issue. And if you look at the totality of what's going on, it seems clear to me that these colleges and universities need to provide outlets for the kind of dissent or the kind of protest that students want. They have to engage those students in what is and is not permissible, and then only then get to the consequences of those students disobeying it. You don't launch the National Guard or the state police or, you know, as a first salvo, right? Because the best security planning is one that de-escalates, that doesn't get to some of these situations. And I think that's what, I think that's the middle lane that you're going to start to see these colleges and universities get to with strong, what we call access controls. You have to control who is on the colleges and universities because we know others will take advantage of the unrest.
Yeah, so long before you perhaps call in the National Guard, the example that we used there, the state troopers that we saw, you have to ensure that you're only dealing with students on your campus. There is, though, a grey area, which is where is the right to free speech? At what point does that become hate speech? Does that become intimidating to certain subsets of the student population, Juliet? And I sort of wonder whether this is a line that the leadership aren't necessarily making clear, even to the point that we were hearing from Isabel there, where she said it's not allowed to have this encampment, but obviously this encampment's going to go and continue and the students aren't worried about disciplinary procedures, but they are being swiped and scanned to make sure they're students. It's sort of, again, where do you draw the lines here and where are the lines allowed to be blurred?
Right. So this is going to be, this is the challenge. I'm at Harvard University. This is the challenge, obviously. We've had our issues. This is the challenge for all colleges and universities. I think it's incumbent on them to make it clear what is permissible protest. Students, whatever their age, they're allowed to protest and where they are allowed to protest versus what is impermissible behavior. So putting up tents, you know, the day before graduation is not permissible. They will be evacuated. They will be dismantled. The gray area, as you describe, is one that is there's no great rule. It is that there is a line between feeling uncomfortable or not liking what you hear, and feeling that your identity is under threat of violence. And that line, if it's crossed, right, it's not perfect, that is when public safety steps in. But I will tell you, just I've been on air all day, just looking, the threat, the physical threat is going to increase the quicker that these colleges and universities are sort of deploying massive law enforcement. We have this technique in safety and security called de-escalation. These colleges and universities know how to do it. And we should go back to those tactics. It's engagement with the students, even if we don't like what they're saying. It is setting rules of appropriate conduct. And then they face the consequences. There's no perfect answer. Every college and university is struggling through this. But the idea that protest per se is anti-Semitic is not accurate. We know who's protesting. We've interviewed Jewish protesters. And also that this can be solved by the single firing of a university president is ridiculous. I mean, this is a very difficult issue. And it is incumbent on the colleges and universities to also try to de-escalate because it's dangerous for everyone.
Yeah, but you have to accurately define what permissible protest is and what it isn't, and right. Not do perhaps what happened today and look like the situation is completely out of control.
Exactly.
Julia Kayhem. Julia, let's put you in charge. Thank you for that.
it's easy on the outside, but
I know.
Yes,
I know.
De-escalate, that's all I say. But thank you so much for having me.
We heard it. Thank you. All right, now to a case that could have implications for women across the United States. The Supreme Court has heard arguments on whether a federal law ensuring emergency care overrides a state law that restricts abortions. The deliberations all come nearly 2 years since the overturning of Roe v. Wade by the Supreme Court. Paula Reid looks at what's at stake today.
Today, the Supreme Court heard another historic case on abortion as protesters on both sides of the issue gathered out front. The high-stakes hearing focused on Idaho's abortion ban and how it applies in medical emergencies. The state allows exceptions when the life of a mother is at risk, but the Biden administration sued the state, arguing that federal law requires the state to allow the procedure if it is needed to stabilize a patient, even when the mother's condition is not yet life-threatening. Joshua Turner argued for the state and faced a barrage of medical hypotheticals from the liberal justices.
All of these cases are rare, but within these rare cases, there's a significant number where the woman is, her life is not in peril, but she's going to lose her reproductive organs. She's going to lose the ability to have children in the future, unless an abortion takes place.
Conservative Justice Amy Coney Barrett joined her liberal colleagues in pressing Turner on the state's position and how it leaves doctors open to prosecution.
If they were exercising their medical judgment, they could, in good faith, determine that life-saving care was necessary. And that's my point, is this a subjective
but some
standard.
Doctors couldn't. Some doctors might reach a contrary conclusion, I think, is what Justice Sotomayor is asking you. So
if they reached
the conclusion that the legislature's doctors did, would they be prosecuted under Idaho law?
No. If they reached the conclusion that the Dr. Reynolds, Dr. White did, that these were life-saving.
What if the prosecutor thought differently? What if the prosecutor thought, well, I don't think any good faith doctor could draw that conclusion. I'm going to put on my expert.
And that, Your Honor, is the nature of prosecutorial discretion.
Justice Barrett and Chief Justice John Roberts had tough questions for both sides and could end up being the swing votes that determine the outcome. Elizabeth Prelonger argued for the government that Idaho is subject to a federal law called the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, or EMTALA.
In Idaho, doctors have to shut their eyes to everything except death, whereas under EMTALA, you're supposed to be thinking about things like, is she about to lose her fertility? Is her uterus going to become incredibly scarred because of the bleeding? Is she about to undergo the possibility of kidney failure?
She faced questions from conservatives about how to protect unborn children.
Have you seen abortion statutes that use the phrase unborn child? Doesn't that tell us something?
It tells us that Congress wanted to expand the protection for pregnant women so that they could get the same duties to screen and stabilize when they have a condition that's threatening the health and well-being of the unborn child.
A decision in this case is expected in late June, right in the middle of the presidential election cycle. Now, historically, Republicans have used the issue of abortion to galvanize a certain block of their supporters. But since Roe was overturned, we've actually seen that this can galvanize Democrats. So a lot riding on this decision from the high court. Julia.
Thanks to Paula Reed there. Now, Arizona's House of Representatives has voted to overturn a Civil War abortion ban in the state. Three Republican lawmakers broke ranks with their party and voted with Democrats to repeal the ban. The move paves the way for a reinstatement of a 15-week ban on abortions that makes exemptions for medical emergencies. Now, straight ahead, Chipotle chips away at diners' budgets. Meals are costing more, but the earnings are still very tasty. The company's chief financial officer will be here to discuss their earnings. And Shogun Success, the action-packed finale of the hit streaming drama, has just been released. My interview with lead actor and producer of the series, Hiro Sanada, just ahead. A behind-the-scenes look at the streaming sensation, as well as the prospects for season two. Stay with us.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
Lately, we have been paying attention to a very different virus, bird flu, which is caused by the H5N1 virus. If you start to hear that it's circulating in pigs, that would be a concern.
That means I would go from sleeping with one eye open to one and a half eyes open. Yeah, that would make me very concerned.
Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to First Move and a volatile session on Wall Street and a Meta meltdown topping today's money move. U.S. stocks closing Wednesday's session. Little change, though pressured by rising bond yields. But tech shares, however, were able to post modest gains. Look, it's 0.1%. We'll call that positive. Tesla shares had their best day in more than a year, however, rising 12%. As we told you on yesterday's show, investors are revved up by news that the firm is still working on that lower-priced car. But tech could come under pressure in the next session after the release of Meta's latest earnings report, earnings and revenues from Facebook's parent company topping expectations. But it actually posted weaker than expected sales guidance. And take a look at that reaction. Shares are down more than 16% in after-hours trade. In the meantime, mostly higher across Asia, with Hong Kong stocks rallying over 2% for the second straight session. The Nikkei up well over 2% today, and we'll see what today's session brings. In the meantime, Chipotle wrapping up another delicious quarter with some strong earnings results. Revenues coming in at $2.7 billion. That topped expectations. Its net profit of just over $350 million was up more than 20% from a year earlier. The popular U.S. burrito chain has been raising prices, but it seems customers are still willing to pay. Here in New York, for comparison, a regular chicken burrito now around $12, including tax. In comparison, a McDonald's Big Mac is less than $7, but then you have to add up, of course, what the meal costs to the stock. Is up, as you can see, a massive performance there over the past year. In extended trade, its shares have jumped more than 60% over the past year. Joining us now, Jack Hartung is the CFO of Chipotle Mexican Grill. Jack, always a pleasure to have you on the show. Your results seem to defy inflation-induced gravity each quarter, and that's what we're seeing from other restaurant brands. Tell me how you're managing it and how ruthless you're being about costs.
Yeah, you know, from a cost standpoint, I would say things are in more of a normal environment. A couple of years ago, we saw raging inflation, both from a labor standpoint and ingredient standpoint as well. I would say things are more normal. Our inflation expectations for this year are generally in that low to mid single digit range. You know, we have one exception where we have a little bit higher inflation in California because of wage increases there. But it seems like it's very, very normal. Our pricing, we did take a modest price increase at the end of last year, 3%, and we don't anticipate taking any more pricing this year at all. And as a result, our customers, our transactions are very, very strong. We see our average check is increasing as well because folks are adding sides more than they have in the past. And so we feel like the folks that are coming to Chipotle, they love the customization. They love our food ethos. Our throughput is some of the fastest throughput we've seen in a number of years, and we're still very, very affordable.
I mean, you're also improving your margins rather than going in the other direction. I just want to make sure I heard correctly there. You're saying no further price increases this year, or do you reserve the right perhaps to inch higher depending on what we see?
You know, it's possible that we would take one at the end of the year. We'll certainly take a look at it, but right now we don't have any plans. You mentioned, Julia, our margins, 27.5%. That's the highest we've seen in, you know, quite some time, especially for our first quarter, which normally isn't our peak margin season. So from a health of our business, from a margin standpoint, we just don't see that we need to raise prices at this time. And as long as inflation on both wages and ingredients stays relatively benign, I think we can carry through with that.
Yeah, makes perfect sense. Talk to me about the FAST Act in California, because you've hinted that as well. And just for our audience that may not be familiar, that raised across most parts of the fast food industry wages to, or minimum wage to, $20 an hour. What impact has that had on you? Because I think you're seen as one of the brands that can perhaps manage that most easily compared to some of the smaller businesses. Is it making an impact on hiring?
Yeah, so far not on hiring. We've got great staffing across the country, and it's in particular in California. We already paid, before this increase, we paid typically at or above what others are paying. We also have terrific benefits. We have education benefits. We have debt-free degrees. We have a 401k program where we will match what you put in, but you can use that to pay off your student debt. We also have like healthcare mental health, benefits as well. So we have a whole package that people really are attracted to. From just a wage standpoint, our wages did increase by about 20%, or not quite 20%. That's significant when labor is such an important part of our business. We did take a price increase of just 6 to 7%. Now, Julia, that's not going to hold our margins. Our margins are going to decline as a result of this, but allowed us to at least break even on a dollar basis. And so we feel like that was the right thing to do. We still feel like we're very affordable in California, but we felt like we had to at least take that modest price increase to offset the very significant increase in wages.
Do you think it was the right decision that they made in order to raise prices this way? As you said, you're managing it. It is going to have an impact on margins. But for others, you're sort of balancing business versus worker.
It's a great question, Julia. I mean, we'll be okay. We have very strong brand recognition. It's more the little guys on the franchisees. That's where it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. If you're a small business owner, if you're a franchisee who has debt payments to be made, and if you can't raise prices or you can't raise prices enough to offset this, it's going to put some pressure on them. Hopefully that doesn't happen. I mean, we're in the restaurant business and we want to win, but we don't want restaurant business to go out, to really go out of business. We don't want small business owners to have to close their doors or restrict their hours. So hopefully everyone will be okay, but time will tell.
Yeah, Jack, nice response. Community sensed response, because obviously it's good for you, but not necessarily good for consumers, all the workers. Jack, fantastic to have you with us as always. Jack Harting, the CFO of Chipotle Mexican Grill. Congratulations once again on the work. All right, several neighborhoods in Kenya remaining submerged on Wednesday after another day of heavy rainfall in the East African nation. Some roads in Nairobi were closed. Nationwide train services were suspended. On Tuesday, a UN agency said at least 32 people have died. Chad Myers joins us now. Chad, some devastating flooding wherever you seem to be looking in the world. Just talk us through what we've seen there and whether more is expected.
It is. Absolutely, it is. They have two rainy seasons, one in the spring and one in the fall. It's when that intertropical convergence zone gets right over these Central African countries. And right here, or just more rainfall coming down. But look at the numbers here. Just in the past 72 hours, almost 300 millimeters in the city. And yes, over the past month, more than 300 millimeters. If you look at the percentages, we're looking at 150 to 200% of normal coming down. So yes, it rains and yes, it floods. But when you're 200% of normal, it's very little you can do about it. And here's the first rainy season. This is spring, when the winds from the south and the winds from the north converge. They converge right over the area right now. And then it moves away and summer will be completely dry. And you will see cracked roadways and lawns that are just completely dead and dry and brown. And then all of a sudden, again, later on this fall, the rain comes back again. But we're not supposed to have this much so fast. It's supposed to be a long, steady rain. We call these the long rains we're in, where the fall are the short rains. Well, it has been long and it has been heavy, and more rain is coming down tonight, coming down again tomorrow, and again, another 150 millimeters on top of the 300 that's already fallen. Now, you can kind of do the math, and I know for people that don't use the metric system as much, it's kind of hard. But if you think about 100 millimeters of rain, that's 4 inches. So when you talk 200 or 300, you take 4 and you make 8, and then you make 12 inches of rain that have already fallen and are going to continue to fall here. Back toward China, East Asia, good morning to you. The rains has really moved away from most of China for today. But it'll be back again for tomorrow in this Delta area, the Pearl River Delta. More heavy rainfall coming in. This is Hong Kong and just north of there. Places that have already seen 300 millimeters. Again, do the math, 12 inches of rain here. And so it's still going to be raining today, tomorrow, and into the weekend. And some spots here in purple, that's 250 to 300 millimeters. Another 12 inches on top of places that are already flooding. Julia.
Wow. One never wishes to wish one's life away, but I'm sure they can't wait to get through to next week.
That's right.
through this weather. Chad, thank you. Chad Myers there. All right, more First Move after this. Stay with us. Welcome back to First Move with a look at more international headlines this hour. Hamas has released a video of Israeli-American hostage Hirsch Goldberg Pollen. It's the first proof he survived serious injuries he sustained during his capture from the Nova Music Festival on October 7th. The clip is undated but contains references suggesting it was filmed this week. The US president has formally approved a $95 billion foreign aid package for Ukraine, Israel and Taiwan. President Biden called it a, quote, good day for world peace as he signed the bill into law. It includes $61 billion for Ukraine, with the president saying military shipments are beginning right away. And we're waiting for the judge to issue his decision on whether Donald Trump violated the gag order in his criminal hush money trial. The former president is barred from speaking publicly about both witnesses and jury members. The Manhattan trial will resume Thursday morning. And the head of Japan Airlines, who started her career as a flight attendant, hopes more women will pursue top corporate roles. Mitsuko Tottori is the first woman to lead the company. She's a trailblazer in Japan, which ranks last among G7 nations when it comes to women holding senior management positions. Hanako Montgomery spoke to the new airline president, and she joins us now. Hanako, great to have you with us. This is classic. She's not stepping in at an easy time, and it's often that women are put in these roles when the job is incredibly tough and then people wonder why they struggle. Give us a sense of the leadership vision she presents.
Yeah, Julia, she really reinforced this idea and emphasized the fact that safety was of the utmost priority to her. Of course, her post was announced just weeks after that horrible plane collision we saw on January 2nd when 5 Coast Guard crew members died after colliding with a commercial flight from JAL. So that incident, she said, and of course all of her experience as a flight attendant, right, a career that spans several decades, she said, really reinforced and reaffirmed her belief that safety should be the number one priority for Japan Airlines going forward. Here's what she told us.
An entire plane swallowed by flames. Smoke and fear filled the cabin. These are the dramatic scenes from Japan that unfolded on screens across the world when a Japan Airlines flight collided with a Coast Guard aircraft on the runway. But mass tragedy was avoided that January night. 5 Coast Guard crew members were killed, but all 379 aboard commercial flight 516 escaped unscathed. A miracle. Mitsuko Tottori, Japan Airlines' incoming president, attributes to passenger cooperation and a well-trained crew.
We are constantly updating our operations based on the lessons we have learned from past case studies. I think we were able to put these lessons to the test.
But for Tottori, safety isn't just a priority, it's instinct. Starting as a flight attendant, she rose through the ranks in a country where women hold less than 13% of senior and leadership roles, the lowest among G7 nations, according to the World Economic Forum. She's now the first woman and former flight attendant to become JAL's president. But her rise, she says, shouldn't come as a surprise.
I hope that Japan will soon become a place where people are not surprised when a woman becomes a president.
Tottori's remarkable career began in 1985, just 4 months before the deadliest single aircraft accident in aviation history. JAL Flight 123 crashed and killed 520 people on board, leaving just 4 survivors, and Tottori with the haunting reminder that safety is irreplaceable.
Safety must be a priority for everyone working at JAL. That important value has been engraved in my heart.
But her dedication to safety faces another critical test. Boeing, long a JAL partner, now grapples with mounting allegations of neglecting aircraft safety and quality following alarming plane incidents and this month's Senate whistleblower hearing.
Are you concerned at all about the whistleblower complaints regarding the gaps in quality and safety of Boeing airplanes?
Well, it seems that the CEO has just changed, so I'm not particularly concerned. I believe they will overcome this, and I will continue to support, communicate with them.
her faith in Boeing strong. But the manufacturer must prove that its aircrafts live up to her indispensable value.
So Mitsuko Tottori Julia has a career that started in 1985 when she started as a flight attendant to now as CEO and president of the company, which is really extraordinary. And just to note, I think, you know, we talked about how she was the first woman to ever lead Japan Airlines, which is one of Japan's biggest airline companies, but also she's the first one with any experience as a flight attendant. Her predecessor had a background in maintenance, and the man who came before him had experience as a pilot. So really, she has a remarkable career that is breaking boundaries and really setting an example for women in Japan, but also across the world, Julia.
Yeah, shattering glass ceilings there. And to her point about seeing a female prime minister in Japan, our answer would be, Hanako, why not? Hanako Montgomery, thank you so much for that great interview. All right, coming up after the break, we're staying with Japan.
I'm Hiroyuki Sanada. You're watching First Move.
Shogun superstar Hiro Sanada joins us as we head back in time to feudal Japan for the epic conclusion of season one. That's next.
The assignment with me, Audie Cornish.
So there have been arrests, suspensions, disciplinary hearings. They're shutting down graduation events.
At this moment, the part of the protests that are admirable are young people calling attention to atrocities.
Michael Roth is the president of Wesleyan University.
I would like to make a space for them to do that, as long as that space doesn't prevent other people from pursuing their education.
Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
Welcome back. If you're a fan of the Japanese hit series Shogun, chances are you may have cancelled your evening plans at some point this week to catch the much-anticipated season finale. Shogun is being compared to such epic dramas as Game of Thrones, Succession, even House of Cards, and it was the most streamed TV premiere for a show developed by FX. Well, I sat down with superstar actor and producer Hiro Sanada, otherwise known as Lord Torunaga, about the role, the authentic showcase of Japanese culture. And of course, the most important question, will there be a season two? Take a listen.
My role, Torunaga, has a real model in the history called Ieyasu. He stopped the war period and then created the peaceful era for about 260 years. That's why he became hero. So he was my own hero as well since I was a kid. And then now I'm playing his role. He's mysterious and strategist, but also a human being, a family man as well, not a stereotypical samurai. So I tried to.
That was a Hollywood depiction of a samurai that you just did there, which actually is another
so
part.
So we tried to make more authentic as much as possible.
Actually, for me, that's the perfect word. The authenticity of this, whether it's to Japanese culture in some way, to Japanese history. I just wonder whether that is part of the success, actually, of this series. For some reason, when perhaps we look at the broader world and understand we're searching for purpose of life, loyalty, family.
I believe so, because this story is, based on the novel and then fictional entertainment.
But,
to make story and character believable, we had to make authentic, to focus on the drama. You know, if nowadays people know about the Japanese culture much more than 80s, and easy to research, so we cannot, make mistakes.
But also, if you're not Japanese, you had to concentrate on this, because 70% of it approximately is in Japanese. So you're watching the story, but you're also having to read the subtitles too. It says something about
a cultural shift in content consumption.
Mm-hmm. And novel and original series in the 80s was, you know, speaking Japanese but no subtitles. So experience as a foreigner.
Yeah.
And then what are they talking about, right? That was 80s. But this time, we put more Japanese lenses into the script and try to, you know, showing the culture or detail, characters more deeper and deeper. And then both sides, not only through the blue eyes, you know, but also we have Japanese eyes in the script.
You helped drive that too, not only as one of the main actors, but also as a producer. And I know and have read that you drew on relationships that you've made both in Japan, but also in the United States over the last, what, four decades. But you really created something here, whether it was costume, mannerisms, again, that goes back to Japanese culture and provided that authenticity.
Yes. Yeah, since I started working in Hollywood, sometimes, you know, misunderstood our culture, you know. So I wanted to correct. The language is also important culture. It's a kind of Shakespeare Japanese. So hard to young actors to say it, including Anna Sawai.
To show your true heart is to risk your life.
She's done a great job, but it was her first samurai period drama. So it was hard to her. So I coached for young actors every day on set. Luckily, we had a Japanese crew who has experience for the samurai drama making for a long time. So I had a team. I felt relaxed and just do my ordinary job acting like a reward.
So does this feel like a successful correction to your point about really actually perhaps for the first time getting something right that wasn't filmed in Japan, it was filmed in Canada, but actually was true to Japanese culture and Japanese history?
I had a pressure, of course, you know, carrying our culture, introduced to the world. But more than pressure, I felt so much fun every day.
What have your Japanese friends said, having watched it? Do they love it too?
Yes.
Good.
Luckily,
so there you go.
From the Japanese audience, you know, a great reaction. And then they said, we waited this kind of drama, authentic samurai drama, a long time, they said. So, oh my goodness. You know.
It was also and is a great showcase and platform for other Japanese talent, young Japanese talent. Mm-hmm. Who's the bright shining star in your mind, the one to watch?
So many young actors in the show, and then especially, you know, Hiroto Kanai played Omi.
Yeah.
He's a great, honest actor. And also Moika Hoshi played Fuji.
Yeah,
her performance was so touching.
Magnetic.
I'm so proud of them.
How was Cosmo, because Cosmo Jarvis, of course, plays Blackthorn.
Yeah.
How was his Japanese, really?
Too good.
Really?
From the beginning.
These people are godless savages.
You know, he's a musician as well.
Yes.
It's a good ear he has.
Oh, I see.
So
interesting.
One lesson getting so good. So I stopped the lesson to the dialect coach. No, don't teach him much. It's episode 1 and 2.
So oh, yes,
he
so he has to struggle.
Yes, yeah, struggle. And he is a great actor, believable actor. Mm. And then he kept his accent of Blackthorn all the time. Since I met him first time, he already prepared his Blackthorn accent. So I never hear his own original accent until the rap.
Wow, so he was in character the whole time.
After the rap, and then he, back to normal, and, hey, hero, I don't know. Oh, this is his real own accent, okay. So he stayed in the character whole 11 months.
Do not be fooled by our politeness, our bows, our maze of rituals.
I'm on episode 9, by the way, and I'm at the Shakespearean tragedy stage because obviously I'm not going to spoil it for people who haven't watched, but sad things happen in episode 9. How would you describe this series in Shakespearean terms? Is it a tragedy?
Yeah, kind of tragedy. But in our culture and at that period, honorable death is very, you know, important, and meaningful death is better than just no meaning, long life. That's the our philosophy at that time. So it looks like, tragedy, but
with purpose.
For the characters, kind of happy ending.
It's a book. It's derived from a book. It follows relatively closely. Is there going to be a series too? You have to tell us, because there will be people, particularly once they've watched the final episode, that are really weighing your words. So speak carefully, my friend. Can you give us hope of a series too?
You know what? We used all the novel already.
Yes, but?
Oh, but we have real history.
Right.
We know what happened in real history. Mm-hmm. So who knows?
You're leaving the door open to a series. You heard it here first. It's a fun interview. Okay, coming up, I can barely bring myself to read this. Oh, Liverpool out of the Premier League title race. We'll have their results on Wednesday night and all the analysis, despite my best efforts of wearing the right colours. Next, stay with us. Welcome back to First Move. Liverpool were in a three-team race for the top league of the Premier League table. Well, maybe not anymore. The Reds suffered a painful defeat against Everton. Dom Riddell joins me now. I think I heard my father's groans across the Atlantic, Don, in a completely unbiased way.
I know.
Can they still do it?
This must have been a difficult evening for you. I'm not so sure they can do it. I mean, of all the teams they could lose to at this stage of the season, Everton away at Goodison Park was about as bad as it could be. It was a really, really difficult night for them. Liverpool, as you know, Julia, have been kind of hemorrhaging points over the last few games. They've dropped now 8 of a possible 12. That is not championship form. And it's certainly not in a season where they're going up against two teams on such brilliant form. Manchester City, of course, the defending champions who seem to always come through at the end. Arsenal are playing brilliantly as well. Remember, they thrashed Chelsea just 24 hours previously. So I think it's going to be so, so difficult for Liverpool to win this title. We can't write them off just yet, but given that they're up against two such very good teams, it is getting harder and harder to see that Liverpool could find a way to win the title again.
But never say never. That's it. Red shirts now for the rest of the season. Don, great to have you with us. Thank you for that report there, Don Riddell. And that just about wraps up the show. Thank you for joining us. I'll see you tomorrow.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.